My name is Mike Stanley. I'm here today on behalf of appellants Max and Scott Hultzwerk here in the courtroom today. They're before this court because Amendment 4 to the Scallop Fishery Management Plan, the License Limitation Program, effectively pushes them out of the Alaska scallop fishery. It's demonstrated in the record that it's not economically viable for them to fish in statewide waters with a single six-foot dredge, and the economics of the Cook Inlet fishery are not sustainable for a vessel to make a living there. Thus, far from enjoying the stable economic environment that was the goal of the LLP, the Hulses are precluded from fishing for scallops anywhere in Alaska on an economically sound basis. And I thought, to illustrate this, I wanted to just refer to a low-tech, I realized, chart that I prepared to discuss the economics. I've given you a little handout, and I've also given it to council that just illustrates this. This is, you know, information that's in the record. I'm just putting it up to try to enhance the argument. This first equation on top refers to break-even fleet size. That is essentially the same equation that the council and NIMS used when they did a break-even analysis for the statewide fishery. They used 650 a pound versus the quota of 800,000 divided by average income, and they came up with a figure, and I'll talk about that in a minute. If they had done that same analysis for Cook Inlet, this is the kind of equation they would have been looking at. And it's part of our contention that they didn't do that. They did not undertake that analysis. Even though they had this information available to them, they had the price, they had the quota, they had the figure for average break-even income for a Cook Inlet vessel, they didn't perform this analysis. And if they had, this is what it would have shown, is that the fishery will support a half of a vessel or less. Now, the government will say not a fair comparison because 135,000 figure in the denominator was indicated by Mr. Copeland, who submitted the information for the Northern Explorer, that was for the whole fishery, whereas Cook Inlet, the numerator is only Cook Inlet. That's a fair criticism. I would accept that criticism. And if the council had undertaken to make this analysis, I would have expected that information to come out. The point we are making, they simply did not do this analysis. They did this analysis for the statewide fishery. They never took a look at the ramifications of confining some vessels to Cook Inlet. It's our contention that this violated National Standard 2 and that it was unfair and inequitable. The bottom equations on this chart are just to sort of, again, illustrate, again, why we are here today. If you look at, even if a full 20,000 pounds of scallops in Cook Inlet is caught at 650 a pound, you have a total X vessel value for the fleet of 130,000. Divide that by the three or four vessels that fish there, that the figure that's noted in the EA and the FRFA, and you get, you know, $33,000 per vessel. You relate that again to the break-even income, you see that you're down to less than 20% of what a Cook Inlet vessel needs to break even, the same standard that the council and NIMS applied to the statewide vessels. So it's really our argument here today that NIMS failed to come to grips with this problem. They failed to really think about what they were doing to these vessels that they were restricting in using a single six-foot dredge. They just didn't look at it, and we contend that violated National Standard 2 and that it was unfair and inequitable. I now want to turn to the break-even analysis, which is the National Standard 2 argument we make. The linchpin of what the council did regarding the size of the fleet that they were going to allow out into statewide waters was this break-even analysis. And I've discussed this in the briefs, and I'm not going to go into it in any great more detail. This, by the way, that I just put up, this is the attachment one to the brief that I put on the brief. You'll find it at ER 142, or anyway, it's taken from that page. What I've done here on this table is just reproduce exactly the two tables of data that were produced in the EA, RIR, IRFA. The top table is the 93 data. The bottom table was the 1998 data. The difference being is that in the 1993 data, the top table, they calculated an average. And they got an average break-even income. And then they used that figure in developing their matrix and in coming to their conclusion about the optimum size of the fleet in statewide waters. Well, with respect to the 1998 data, they did not calculate the average. So I've calculated the average down at the bottom of this chart for informative purposes. And again, I discussed this in the brief, and it's in attachment one to the brief. But what you see is that if they had done the same thing for the 1998 data that they did for the 1993 data, they would have reached had a different denominator in their formula. And the significance of that is really comes down to this, Your Honors. Because the when they used 1993 data, this is the formula. This is the formula that's indicated throughout the record that led them to conclude that they could allow no more than seven vessels out into statewide waters. You know, this analysis was referenced by the council. It was referenced in the EA, RIR, IRFA. It was referenced by NIMS when it published the final rule. They said, we cannot allow more than seven vessels to go out into statewide waters with a full complement of gear, because to do so would prevent attainment of the break-even fleet size. That's what they said in the when they published the final rule. What I've shown here is that if you use the 1998 data and that calculated different calculated average of average break-even income, you end up with a different outcome. You end up with the conclusion that, well, we can have eight vessels that could fish out there in an economically sustainable way.
I have a couple of questions about
sure.
the break-even analysis. Was the break-even analysis raised at the administrative hearing? In terms of
it was presented to the council at the
by and the difference between 93 and 98.
The two tables were certainly available to them. Look at ER 142. That was the analysis that was presented to the council. The council had those two tables, the 93 data and the 1998 data. But essentially what the analysis said is, well, here's some newer data, and they did nothing with it.
Okay.
And that's what we say is the flaw.
And I thought that some of the newer data that they used, like I thought there was like number of landings or some of these things that they used the 98 or the more recent data on, but then they ultimately reverted to the 93 data overall. Is that right?
No. They did use 1998 data in the numerator. They updated
the price
of scallops, and they updated what they thought the quota would be. So they did, and this is what Judge Sedgwick, in his opinion, referred to as the key factors. And undoubtedly, those variables are very important. But what we've tried to stress is that the denominator is also important, because the smaller the denominator, the larger the quotient. And that if they had used this other average break-even income figure, you would have reached a different conclusion. And you say, well, one vessel, what difference does that make? The decision to approve the one option over the other, and this is very clear in the record, council members referenced it, it's referenced in the EA, it came down to one vessel. They said, if you do this, the Wayward Wind, which is the Hulse's vessel, is in. If you go for either recent or historical participation in the outside waters, but if you go this other way, the more restrictive way, the Hulse's are out. And NIFS defends taking the Hulse's out on the grounds that, well, to do anything different would prevent attainment of the break-even fleet size. But that rests on this conclusion that seven vessels in the statewide fishery is what you get.
A lot of this, you can imagine, we're trying to sort out
sure.
these charts. And so then I thought the government said, well, no, actually, if we took some of the 1998 data into effect, you'd actually get a lower number of vessels.
Well, what the government is arguing is that, well, you shouldn't, you know, calculate an average with this line in there. They say you shouldn't include the Cook Inlet vessel because it's not representative of a statewide. Mm-hmm. And our argument is that, well, but they were part of the statewide fleet. The council had let them out into the statewide waters, so why shouldn't they be included in the calculation? In addition, if you look at this top table, there's these 288 Cook vessels in 1993. Well, those vessels are gone by the time we get to 1998. This 1998 data is not only more recent, it's more representative of the situation that was confronting the council.
So just so I'm clear, in the multiple data that was submitted, the 98 data is taken into account to some degree in the numerator, but not the denominator. Is that a good summary?
That's correct.
Or
wrong? Yeah, I would, that's correct.
Okay.
And it's not as if the council or NIMS said, and this is why we are doing that. There's no explanation. You know, we recognize the lesson of Fisherman's Dock case, that if they make an explanation and they offer a justification, they say, well, we wanted to use the 1993 data for this reason. You know, that would be perhaps a different case, but there was no explanation. And again, we think that, you know, that it's important to remind the council and NIMS that they do have an obligation to use the best available information. It's National Standard 2. You know, National Standard 1 is prevent overfishing. National Standard 2, the second in priority, is use the best scientific information available. And they failed to do that in this case, and it could have been critical for the Hulses. I want the court to just think for a minute about the implications of giving NIMS a pass on this issue. The argument would be that then, while they're free to ignore newer data and not provide an explanation, you know, the council has embarked on a very broad program of limited entry, adopting LLP, and there's the IFQ program is in the Alliance versus Brown case. There's a lot of ramifications to this. People's lives are being affected. Businesses are being affected. And it's important, we think, for them to use the best available information. And what if the issue weren't economics but conservation? Would anybody say, yeah, it's okay to use five-year-old data and not provide an explanation for ignoring newer data? Nobody would go along with that. But you certainly can't accept it in this case. Economic data is scientific information, just like conservation information. It should be used, biological information should be used similarly. I'll just kind of conclude my opening remarks with the observation that the Secretary of Commerce is supposed to serve as a check on the councils and to ensure the decisions by the councils are consistent with the national standards. You know, NIMS' role is not just to rubber stamp what the council has done and then perform the ministerial task of turning council action into regulations. You know, they've got a substantive role in assuring that the national standards are met. And with all due respect, I don't think NIMS did that in this case. I think they failed to fulfill that responsibility vis-a-vis what the council did. Instead, I think what we see, and this is reflected in particular in the documents at ER 204, 206, 207, we see an agency that's preoccupied with getting this rule in place on time. You know, the economists came up and told them, you know, you can improve this EA. And one of the ways you can improve it is by looking at this bottom line. That if this bottom line changes, the denominator, that'll change the potion. NIMS, well, we can't. We don't have time to do that. We're in a hurry. We've almost run out of time on this rule, is one quote. It's a powder keg waiting to blow, is another quote. Worried about the timeline. The agency is preoccupied with getting this rule in place on time instead of their substantive duty to make sure that the national standards are adhered to. And it's our view that in this circumstance, this is a prime case for the court to remind NIMS and the council of their duty to enforce the national standards and to send this case back down with that directive. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time for...
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Catherine Barton with the Justice Department. The purpose of a limited license program is to eliminate overcapacity and overcapitalization and excess harvest capacity in the scallop fishery here. At the time that NIMS and the council were considering adopting this limited access program, the fishery had seemed to reach an equilibrium where the current level of effort could be sustained at a general break-even level across the board. And so the council and NIMS decided to basically adopt the status quo and allow vessels to continue to fish at their current, at a level that mirrored their current commitment to the fishery and their current economic dependence on it. And thus it allowed them to continue using, basically what's the issue here is the gear restrictions that was placed on the Hulses, and it allowed the Hulses to continue to use the gear that they had been using, not only for the past, in the past 3 years that constituted the qualifying period during which the gear limitation was based, but over the past decade, they had the larger gear that they want to be allowed to use that is the basis for their action here, underlying it, they hadn't used for more than a decade. So that was an eminently reasonable and fair decision. It complied with all statutory requirements. It's really the Hulses that have come both to the council and to the court and to NIFS and said, we alone should be allowed to increase our capacity over what we had been doing, what anybody had been doing what we had been doing in the fishery at the time in the recent years before there were the limitations. Now let me get to the best scientific information question, the standard two. First of all, this argument should be precluded because it was not raised before the agency. The Hulses were represented by Mr. Stanley in agency proceedings, and he did not raise any of these scientific information arguments, and Vermont Yankee precludes the court from addressing them now, especially in the circumstance where the strongest emphasis of their argument is that the agency failed to justify the lack of use of information, but the agency had no idea that anybody considered that information had to be used. And it does leave us at a disadvantage. We do not have in the record why it seemed apparent to the economist who prepared the break-even analysis, who did look at updated information, decided that this piece of updated information did not need to be included. But there are reasons that we can suggest as to why it wasn't included, and that was because it was first of all, this information, NIFSA only has access to this information if it's provided voluntarily. And it was voluntarily provided by the seven vessels that in 1993 that approximated the average size of the vessel in the fleet. So it was the point with the break-even analysis is to...
I don't get your point on that because I've sat up here and listened to NIFSA also say in other situations that we use this we recognize it's not perfect, but we use voluntarily provided information, and it was appropriate in this case. So I'm happy, you know.
Right. No, I don't mean to say
I'm not quite sure why it wouldn't be appropriate.
Right. I'm just trying to say that, I'm just trying to inform the court that it's not that the index can go out each year and check all this information. But they used what they had, which was provided in 93, and then there were some updates in 1998. It included an atypical vessel that had fished entirely in Cook Inlet until 98 when it may have had some statewide application. I understand it's a vessel that does not fish full year round, and the point of the break-even analysis was to determine what could the statewide fishery sustain. Now let me point out another point about the denominator here. Is that it is the factors in the numerator. It is the landing and prices, and it says this in the record, in the description of the break-even analysis, that those are the primary factors that change the break-even analysis. And indeed, the break-even analysis initially showed that 9 vessels could participate in the fishery. And when it was updated with the more current information, it showed that 6 vessels could participate.
One question I had, I saw that those were two primary factors and that there was use of, as he indicated, the updated pricing information. Although this mixing and matching might have some rationale. In the case that both parties cite to this Brown case out of the Fourth Circuit, one of the reasons that they upheld the decision there was because it was articulated why, you know, certain evidence was chosen and certain evidence was not. Is there anything in the record here that shows why there's a mixing and a matching?
No, Your Honor, that's exactly my point of the problem with it not having been raised in the agency proceedings, is that it certainly could have been something that was seemed evident to the economist, but that didn't seem, and this was presented multiple times to them. It's not that the Hulses were not aware of this. They just never had a problem with it until they were cut out of the fishery. I mean, frankly. And so, so all I can do, because the agency wasn't put on notice, is suggest why he didn't see it as an issue to be addressed that was a problem. And that is because the landings and the price.
Are you saying that nowhere in the proceeding below was the issue of 98 versus 93 data as a whole raised?
Exactly. It was never raised. None of the compliance with Standard 2, the scientifically available information, none of those arguments, which was the entire crux of his argument before this court, was raised before the agency.
So he would have to get around Vermont Yankee.
That was exactly my preliminary point. Is that, and that is why the record is deficient here in terms of the attacks they're bringing. It's exactly the kind of thing that springing the surprise on the agency that Vermont Yankee is intended to avoid. The agency has not had an opportunity to exercise its expertise here. And it may seem to you know, outsiders now that it should have been addressed, but I believe because he did address the factors that were the most volatile and changed the most. And let me fundamentally go finally to this. It wouldn't have changed it anyway. This is not, this part that is in the chart, this 800,000 tons, is not the basis on which the government determined that it was approximately 6 to 7 vessels. If you break even analysis, and let me cite you to a page.
You need to speak into the microphone.
Excuse me.
We record the proceedings.
In the excerpts of record, page 235, for example, the break-even analysis appears several times. It notes that statewide landings averaged 735,000 pounds. Average price during the same period was approximately 6.5 pounds. Based on this more recent information, approximately 6 vessels could participate full-time. If you do the math, that number comes out to the break-even analysis. It comes out to 5.8. That's what they did to come up with this approximately 6 vessels. Now, they point in the chart, because the math is complicated, you're always dividing by 824,000 or 735,000 or, you know, whatever the 58,000, whatever the number is. They did a chart to show at certain levels of landings and certain levels of price where it would come out so that the council and the decision makers could look at it and decide, you know, how much leeway they had based on what figures were put in. But just because there's a 6.3, you know, 800,000, you know, figure in the chart that comes out to 6.3, that's not what they used. So we have, and actually if you do the math with the correct figures in theirs, it comes out to 6.3. So it's the difference between 5.8 and 6.3. So all I'm trying to say in this, it ultimately doesn't make any difference. And I believe that the economist who prepared this analysis didn't deem the change in cost figures to be as volatile and as important and came up with a reasonable analysis. And also let me say that the break-even analysis was confirmed, was consistent with public testimony and by the fishermen in the field, that they were operating at break even, that the current level of effort was the current level that could be sustained. It wasn't solely, I mean, all the decisions weren't just basically on, oh, these are the latest numbers, and we're going to always assume it's 6.5 per pound, and it's, you know, it's a generalization, it's approximation, and it's a guide. So I think for all those reasons, that NIMS did use the best scientific data here should not even be held to justifying this issue that wasn't raised, and that the decision makers had good information to rely on in making that decision. Now, the other point he raised about the Cook Inlet, a break-even analysis for Cook Inlet, again, that's part of their Standard 2 argument, which was not raised to the agency. So the agency was never, it was never suggested that the agency should prepare a separate analysis for Cook Inlet, and that issue should not be decided by the court. But at any rate, the whole point of the effort was to determine what the of the break-even analysis was to determine what level could be of vessels could operate in the statewide fishery. The statute does not require that the government somehow assure that every vessel in the fishery can operate at break-even or make money. I mean, there are vessels that are different sizes. They have different financial burdens with mortgages or not mortgages. I mean, there are a whole variety of issues. So what they did was they focused on the statewide fishery. Now, also, I mean, the Holses had only operated for the last 10 years in Cook Inlet. There were several other vessels that had only operated in Cook Inlet. Without it being raised that there was to the government that there was a problem or to the council with the economics in Cook Inlet, it seems reasonable just to assume that the Cook Inlet vessels were having some kind of success in Cook Inlet, that it made sense for them to operate there. But going beyond common sense, the Holses also testified to the council that they could make it in the Cook Inlet fishery. I think I lost my marker here. But I would like to give you the record site for that.
You could just provide it afterwards,
okay,
a piece of paper to council and to the
okay
board.
It is on excerpts of record page 169. And they say that it's close, that they can make it in Cook Inlet. They said it's close, but by definition, that's what break even is. If you break even, it's close. And they said under the right circumstances, there's a sufficient catch there. So, first of all, we don't...
Does that presume two active vessels in Cook?
Well, I don't know what their testimony assumes. There were four, I believe, at the time, operating in Cook Inlet, and one was eliminated in the... Excuse me?
I said one went away, I know.
Yes. Yes, one, I believe, had only fished in 98, and you had to have 2 years qualifying between 96 and 98. To stay in the fishery. And there were, you know, anytime you do a limited access program, somebody gets limited and somebody has complaints. The complaint here of the Holses is that they weren't allowed to increase their capacity to a level they hadn't fished in over a decade. It was absolutely fair. They have another argument that it was not a fair and equitable program. But it treats all individuals similarly situated the same. You can continue doing what you were doing in the period 96 through 98. And they opted to stay in the Cook Inlet fishery throughout that whole decade. They have some circumstances that caused them difficulties in fishing statewide, but other people overcame those difficulties, and at times they did make choices to just fish in Cook Inlet when they were not limited. I believe, unless there were other issues in the brief that were not raised in the opening arguments, so I won't address those unless there are any questions.
Very well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
First, want to address the Vermont Yankee argument. This argument by the government saying that we're precluded from raising these issues of these flaws in the analysis, they didn't raise that in the district court. And it's our contention that under the well-accepted rules set forth in U.S. v. Oregon and other cases outlined in our brief, they can't raise it for the first time on appeal. And part of the problem is that they come up with two cases here that we believe don't support the proposition, again, for the reasons set forth in our brief. And more to the point, if you look at the cases, Vermont Yankee and the other cases that they cite, all those cases involve administrative tribunals, quasi-judicial proceedings, or some kind of formalized proceeding where a party has intervened, where there's complaints, there's witnesses, there's, in other words, it's akin to a judicial proceeding, or a quasi-judicial proceeding. You know, Vermont Yankee was nuclear licensing. A party had intervened, they had participated in a formal evidentiary hearing. In Tucker Truck Lines, which is cited at page 21 of their brief, it was a licensing, I think an ICC, old ICC licensing case. And again, there had been complaint, there had been witnesses, there had been hearing. In the Chrysler case that they cite, it was an appeal of a special project licensing that had special procedures, that parties intervened. And indeed, there's a whole list of cases. The Johnson case, for instance, that they cited in footnote 5 on page 22 of their brief, that was a workers' comp case. These are all cases where it's more like a judicial process. And just like in a judicial process, if you don't raise it at the trial level, you can't raise it on appeal. And that's the point we're making here, is they can't raise this argument on appeal because they didn't raise it at the trial level. That is a far different situation from a Magnuson Act, you know, kind of a testimony and APA rulemaking. They cite no case for the proposition that in APA rulemaking, if you don't, and you're noticed, you know, and make a public comment on the rule, on a particular problem with the rule, therefore you're foreclosed from judicial review of that rule. There's no authority for that proposition. They're trying to take Vermont Yankee completely out of context and extend it to the rulemaking context, and that just doesn't work if you look at the cases. And when you really think about the policy that they're trying to suggest here, you know, in the brief they say the failure to use 1998 data was, quote, readily apparent, and the failure to consider the Cook Inlet economics was, quote, manifest. You know, in other words, it's obvious. Mr. Spruill saw it. Their own economist saw that there was a problem if you had a different denominator. What they're kind of saying is that, well, yeah, we realize that the flaw was obvious, but unless you tell us it's obvious, we can't be held accountable. What's the public policy served by that? They have a need to undertake the analysis properly in the first instance. They don't need to be reminded of it again. They're on the economist side.
I suppose the question of when things are raised has to do with whether they're raised at a time when the deficiency could be remedied easily. And if it's raised at the administrative level, then they can do something about it. If it's first raised in the district court, means you just start all over again, I guess.
Well, but that in this case, you have their own economist raise the question of the denominator, if you will, the question of the average operating costs. And this is, if you look at it, it's that series of documents, ER-202, 203, and then a response. And basically, the deputy head of the agency at that time says, we don't have time to consider this. So it was raised administratively, albeit after the council had made its decision, but it was raised in time for NIMS to do something about it, but no, we don't got enough time to deal with this. You know, we got to get this rule in place. It's a powder keg waiting to blow. I want to address the one other point that council made about that all that happened here is the council adopted the status quo. That's not correct. What happened is that when they first looked at this, the alternatives. The recent participation period was 1996 and 1997. They got a plea from a Cook Inlet vessel. Hey, I fished for the first time in 1998. This is the Northern Explorer. Let me in. Council let him in. They expanded the recent participation period specifically to allow that vessel to be able to fish. And so to suggest that they just adopted the status quo is not supported by the record. There was an inconsistent treatment of those two vessels. They took the one vessel and they said, yeah, you can go out there, even though you bought a latent license, which we think is a problem, and you know, even though we've been specifically warned that this may complicate the economics out there, but we'll let you get out into the statewide fishery, and you can use, you know, the full complement of gear or whatever your boat will handle. But when it comes to the Hulses, another Cook Inlet vessel, you're out. You know, the idea that they just adopted the status quo was not correct. They allowed one statewide vessel or one Cook Inlet vessel out. They kept another cook in, the pen didn't.
But it did expand to the additional year across the board. It just happened to affect one vessel.
Well, but it was.
I knew it would. But in other words, they didn't say all vessels are subject to having to show that they operated in a 2-year period, but this vessel gets to show that it operated within a 3-year period. They said any vessel that operated.
That's correct, Your Honor. But they were the only vessel that was affected. There was no other vessel that benefited from that. Yeah, they were the only vessel, and that was the reason why that was done, was to help that guy accommodate his expansion, to on citywide waters. And let's not forget, the Hulses. It's not like when they say they're expanding, they've been out in citywide waters. They were pioneers in this fishery. They fished out there for many years prior to the set of circumstances that kind of kept them off the water for a few years. It's not like this is something where they've never fished out there. They've fished out there for many years.
There are others that historically fished and didn't fish at all during these 3 years, and they're out completely.
Your Honor, if you look at
table
ER 146, table 3.4.1, what you'll see is that after that Mr. Big incident, where they had to close the fishery for a year and a half, half the vessels left the fishery. They didn't leave it because of the LLP. They left because the fishery, it was closed for a year and a half. They had to go do something else, and they found something else to do. There were no vessels. The LLP did not really cut out anybody, at least as far as the vessels that had formerly fished in statewide water. So there was one vessel that tried to get out from Cook Inlet, that claimed it had some landing, I think turned out not to be true. But the LLP by itself didn't throw anybody out, except it panned the Hulses in the Cook Inlet, where they can't make a living. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Matters submitted.